in Seattle, Seattle. And you need to buy yourself a home. We'll be right there for you, because we're the realtors that you can trust. So go to RodandConsidDow.com.
Don't go anywhere unless you want to. It's the Ron and Don Show, starring Ron and Don, and sometimes me, at ronanddon.com.
Hey, you guys, what's going on? Welcome to episode 706 now of the Ron and Don Show, and we are live from the Les Schwab Studios.
What is up, Ron and Don Nation?
Hey, coming up on the Ron and Don Show, we're going to talk about Ron's trail race. In fact, I was there. Gunnar O'Neill was there, some other people there, and we'll see if he's able to finish his first 5K in a while. Also, we got to talk about the world's most valuable shipwreck ever. We're $17 billion, and it is about to be explored and extracted from the ocean floor. Before we get to that, though, let's get to this. Kind of an interesting all-city meeting up in Edmonds, where a lot of the citizens got together with the people there locally in the government, and they were all having a chit chat, and they said, wow, we do not really like the fact that we have these beautiful homes and beautiful neighborhoods. In fact, we just sold a home in the Talbot neighborhood. And in fact, we put our home on, we sold it day two. There were lots of people interested in this home. We had an all cash buyer. And it sold for hundreds of thousands of dollars more than we were asking in the Talbot neighborhood, which is not down in the bowl. People in Edmonds always want to live down in the bowl. And they're like, yeah, the Talbot neighborhood is in that Mount Lake Terrace. It's almost Mount Lake Terrace, but it's not. And at the same time, the values have climbed there. One of the reasons they've really climbed is because some of the schools, also the access to the water, people feel super safe up there. The policing's great. The fire department's great. And these homes sit on really big lots. You'll see lots are 13,000, 16,000 square feet. Think about that here in Seattle. People are selling $2 million homes that are sitting on lots that are only 2,800 square feet. If you have a lot that is 6,000 square feet in Seattle, that is a ginormous lot. And guess what? If a contractor comes along or a builder comes along in a 6,000 square foot lot, they sometimes want to tear down that single family home and they want to build three homes on that lot. Well, guess what? There's a state ordinance up at Edmonds now where they and other townships like this are going to have to do the same thing. And Ron, there's a big pushback right now in Edmonds saying, hey, can we have a moratorium or can we have a timeout? Because we don't want ADUs and backyard cottages in our beautiful neighborhoods with these big, beautiful, luscious lots where we have our single family homes. And the last thing we want to do is turn into Seattle. That's why we moved to Edmonds in the first place.
This is a question that is plaguing communities, not just in the Pacific Northwest, but all across America. How do we answer the question of lack of housing and specifically affordable housing? And so I don't think anyone that has their eyes open would look around and go, that's not a problem. It totally is a problem. And if there was an easy answer to it, we would probably have figured it out by now. The thing that I don't get on all of these, and I was talking to one of our clients who works in big skyscrapers, and she's like a CFO and that sort of stuff. And I was like, what's it like to always be getting the stick and the carrot from the state when you guys take all the risk and they want you to provide affordable housing? And she's like, yeah, it doesn't feel great. And these builders and these companies, we run on relatively thin margins that can take multiple years to complete a project. And right now the solution seems to be from the state. Hey, we're going to try to incentivize and or penalize people into doing what we want you to do. The state saying, we want affordable housing. We want more housing stock in the area. So we're going to use just the stick and the carrot. And I have yet to have anyone reach back out to me and explain to me why the state just doesn't do some of this themselves. So if we know there is a shortage of affordable housing and that the state is the biggest landowner in the state, like the city of Seattle owns more land than any other private landowner. Probably the same for the city of Edmonds. They control the permitting process. They control the tax revenue. They control the inspections for building permits. And they control most the more land than anybody else. And so if we need this stock, I would like to see the state or the cities step in and go, hey, we're going to take some of our land and our resources and the tax revenue that we have, and we're going to build these things. We're going to control the pricing on it to get people out there to be able to afford this stuff. And so I think that the city of Edmonds, it's easy to go, oh, you're a NIMBY and you just don't want this in your backyard. But we see that all over the place. And so just changing these regulations and forcing people's hands, I guess it can solve a problem. But here's the thing that happens, that as you've seen and you just mentioned up there in Edmonds, the type of housing you're going to build when you make these lots denser, and the type of housing that that folks are going to construct, if they can navigate, the only people that can navigate the procedure and afford to buy this are in the upper echelon of income to begin with. And so they're not going to build, they're going to build the highest and best for that lot, which is not affordable housing. So if you have a $1.5 million house in Edmonds with this oversized lot, you're not going to build a condo or an ADU in the back that's worth $100,000, you're going to build something that's commensurate to that neighborhood. So it doesn't accomplish what the state wants it to accomplish. I get that they're trying to make a policy that's going to provide more housing stock at an affordable rate. This, the evidence that I've seen is this doesn't do that. And I even look at the neighborhood that we're in right now. If you build an ADU on Queen Anne, because they changed the rules for that, it's not affordable. Like, you're not getting a blue collar worker that's going to move in and be able to afford the type of housing that's the infill housing in this neighborhood. And so what do? They'll go to across the water to a place like Ballard, and they'll go, okay, we're just going to rezone this entire swath of land. And they kind of arbitrarily pick a line or a road and say, everything on the other side of the road is going to be rezoned, and we're going to put the light rail through here. And then all of that stuff gets gobbled up at inflated prices. All the new things that are built after the zoning happened, none of that is affordable. So, and I get the desire to say, hey, we don't want to get into the public housing business anymore, like we had in Chicago back in the day, or New York, that turned into slums, or we saw it in New Orleans, turns into these housing projects that are a blight. So we're going to put this out into the private sector. This model just doesn't work. It just doesn't work. You're not incentivizing the carrot and the stick thing. Does not do what you want it to do. It does not create affordable housing. It will create more housing stock eventually, but it's not going to be affordable by any stretch of the... You're not going to get a barista or a police officer or a teacher in Edmonds that can go in then and afford the housing that's going to be built in these infill lots. It's just not going to happen.
No, that's a great point. And the problem is the dirt there, it's too late. It's like trying to build affordable transportation or a subway system in Seattle. It's too late, right? So we're having, instead of building a subway system underground, we're having to build a very expensive light rail system above ground, because that's kind of what we have. And the problem is this. It all comes down to, what is a builder willing to pay for the dirt? There was a very small 3,800 square foot lot that is up near Green Lake. There's a house sitting on that lot. It's two bedroom, it's one bath. And if you sold the house retail, it's worth just under $900,000. But I talked to a builder, and that builder was prepared to pay $1.1 million for the same piece of dirt. And what is he going to do? He's going to go in there, to Ron's point, and jam a house in there. He may jam a backyard cottage in there or an ADU. And then he's going to sell those things together. So he pays $1 million for the property. He builds for $1 million. And at the end of the day, maybe $1.2 million, $1.3 million. So he's trying to profit $700,000, $800,000. And because housing has gotten so expensive here, where homes are now selling for $3 and $4 million. That's why the dirt is so expensive. And then just construction materials, just to buy a box of nails. I was talking to my roofer the other day and I said, hey, how come roofs in the past 5 years have gone from $6,000? Some roofers are charging $30,000 to do your roof, just a basic roof, which is incredible, right? Someone's going to charge you 30, call me, because I have someone who'll probably do it for 19 on a ranch house. But still, 19 is a lot more than six when you could do that a number of years ago. It's because the materials are so expensive, and it's because everyone went to college, that did go to college, and nobody went to trade school. Right? So try to find a plumber. And I bet you did when your pipes blew up. Very, very hard. Very, very. In fact, you talk to anyone out there, and even someone like me, I just told someone just now, that's what I was doing when Ron was talking. One of you wanted to know who my plumber was. And so I told you, I just texted to, but I thought about not doing it because it's so hard to find a plumber. It's so hard to find people in the trades. As a result of that, the trades, it's much more expensive. If you're going to hire an electrician, that starts on a job for some electricians at $185 an hour. So that all gets passed along to housing costs. And that's why housing is so expensive too, because the dirt is so expensive and the housing you're building itself is so expensive. So if you look though, like what they've done along Highway 99, I have some friends that are involved in some investments there where they're building these apartments. That's a little more affordable. And some of these hotels and motels that have turned into crack houses, and there's a lot of prostitution that's run around there. You see along Highway 99 where they're trying to clean that up. And then you have apartments where maybe you have a 315 square foot apartment. And then along with that, maybe you have a common kitchen and even a common place to take a shower, go to the bathroom. And if you're single, that's okay. That's really hard. If you're, let's say you've just gone through a situation with domestic violence, you were married to someone, they left, man or woman, because it happens both ways, but mostly to women. And then you have a couple kids and you're staying at Mary's place and you can only stay there for so long. You stay there for a year and kind of retool and get a job and figure things out. But now you want to go and find some affordable housing and go out and work. Be very, very difficult to do that in Edmonds, where, again, I just shared, we sold a house in the Talbot neighborhood for around $1.5 million, right? Kind of a Brady Bunch house, a beautiful home, a great couple. We love representing them. But this was a house, you know, when they purchased this house that you could have bought, I think, for maybe $150,000. So housing costs have become so expensive. I think the point that Ron made, if you can afford the house on the property, you can also afford the cottage in the backyard. And then sometimes what people do is they'll condominiumize that property and then you could solve one or the other. But some of these cottages, like if you were to buy a cottage in my neighborhood, it's like $1 million for 800 square feet. And that again is not affordable. So we will see you on the other side of this. Hey guys, Ron and Don here for Les Schwab. You know, when it comes to your safety, your family's safety on the road, Les Schwab, well, they have you covered. Yeah. Les Schwab tires, wheels, brakes, batteries, alignment, steering, suspension, everything they sell and service is focused on your safety. Plus, they want to save you a lot of money. Now, right now, during the Les Schwab spring tire sale, you can save up to $80 instantly when you purchase a set of four select tires, plus $50 with Les Schwab financing for a total of $130. Stop by or book your appointment at LesSchwab.com. That's LesSchwab.com. That's Les Schwab. Doing the right thing since when? 1952. All right, so this is how real estate works. I'm at a Seahawks game, and I'm watching the Seahawks win the Super Bowl, and I'm in my friend George's seat, and I'm sitting next to my friend Mike Martin. Known Mike now over a decade. He calls me the other day, says, hey, I got a tech friend. He's in Hawaii, owned a property in Green Lake. He's going to fix it up. He went to Hawaii, said, I'm never going home. So he's had this rental now for 10 years. His name is Jude. So Mike puts me in touch with Jude. Jude calls me and says, hey, I got to sell this house. I call Scotty. We go over the house, and this house has a foundation problem, has a roof problem, has lots of problems. And in order to fix this house and bring it to market, it's going to take about $100,000, and then the house is going to be worth about $925,000. Anyway, there's a builder that Jude knows that says, hey, well, I'll give you $835,000. And then there's a neighbor that says, hey, I'll give you $850,000. And then what I did is I got on the phone with one of my builder friends, because again, I don't like seeing homes torn down, but there's some that have to be torn down when they have bad foundations, right? And this is a home that has to come down. This builder said, you know what? I'll pay $1,060,000 for that particular house. So, case closed. There are builders right now paying more for properties than people are willing to pay when they step in and say, wow, this thing has a bad foundation. This thing is still in oil. This has a bad roof. There's a lot of work to do here. So while many homes I like to see restored, some can't be, right? So when you need us, if you have a piece of property, if you have an old home, it has a bad leaky roof, lots of deferred maintenance, call us. Because sometimes the best thing to do is to fix it up and bring it to market if you have the funds to do so. And sometimes the best thing to do is to create a new property and reimagine it. Because guess what? Here in Seattle, yeah, there's not a lot of property just laying around. So when you need us, whether it's wholesale, retail, investing, buying, selling, let's sit down. RonandDonSitDown.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the Ron and Don Show. I've done a lot of reading on this. I was always interested in The Wreck of the Edmunds Fitzgerald because I grew up that song by Gordon Lightfoot. And I remember when I first had a good understanding of the internet and what it could do is I wanted to know about The Wreck of the Edmunds Fitzgerald and if that was really true because I grew up on the Great Lakes. And it's a true story. If you get some time, read about it. If you've never been to the Great Lakes, they're great. It's like going to the Grand Canyon, and sometimes you forget that the Grand Canyon is hundreds of miles long. It's hard for your brain to comprehend because you typically see it in pictures, but when you stand on the canyon edge, you go, wow, this is really grand. Same on Lake Michigan. I remember growing up fishing with my uncle or my grandfather. It is like being out on the Puget Sound or somewhere out on the Pacific, off of Waikiki at times. And then sometimes it gets very violent. Lots of wind. There's a reason why they call Chicago the Windy City. And I remember there'd be a small craft advisory and you'd want to turn around in your boat and not only book it back to the docks, but then a lot of those docks would close to protect the harbor, as they would say, got to protect the harbor. So anyway, very, very, very scary at times. And I could see how big size of an ocean liner, like the Wreck of the Edmunds Fitzgeralds, could go down. So then I started reading about all the things that had crashed in the Great Lakes. And then I started reading about, even moving here in Lake Washington, do you know there's over 413 boats and aircraft, because they sent a sonar down there. They're at the bottom of the lake. It's a very deep lake. If you've ever been out there in a boat, some places over 300 feet deep, right? So sitting at the bottom of the lake. In fact, Boeing has 11 different planes that sit down there, some of those that have been test piloted. So over the years, I have read a lot about wrecks, and then we all know about the Titanic. And then I was really interested about some of the wrecking crews that go down there and have brought up some of the treasures from the Titanic. And what I didn't know is that there's lots of international rules and regulations that people break all the time. And they will go down and with sonar, submersibles, sometimes manned, sometimes not. And they will end up when no one is looking, because you can't sit down there with a police department and say, we're going to park around the Titanic and see if anyone wants to come and salvage this. And so over the years, there are salvage companies that will go down and they will salvage a wreck. And instead of bringing those items up, what they'll do is they'll move them to a different place in the ocean. And then their submersibles will come back up and it's like nothing to see here. And then they'll return maybe a year later when no one is looking and they will pick up whatever they salvage. So lots of that is happening and going on. And Ron, it brings us to this story about a wreck that we think is worth, get this, $17 billion. This might be one of the greatest treasures ever found on the ocean floor, right?
Yeah, it's a English boat. And here's where you need to pull out your scorecard and see how you would land on this if you were a judge or a jury. So the vessel is from England. And the vessel had 200 tons of silver, emeralds, and 11 million gold coins on it, along with a lot of human beings that were on this vessel. It was shipwrecked near the Colombian coast. And in 1708, so you have this incredibly valuable ship or the incredibly valuable cargo. A lot of men died on this when it went down. And then you have in modern times, some Americans that were searching for this. And so when the wreck was discovered, the Americans were like, hey, we want jurisdiction over this. We want to be able to pull this up. And the English are saying, time out, Sparky. That is an English vessel. So clearly England has jurisdiction over this vessel. And then Colombia is like, time out, both of you. This is in our waters. And so this is off the coast of Colombia. Therefore, it is Colombian property, and it happened in 1708. So the fact that it's here now, you don't have unlimited time to take a claim on this. So this gets sort of sued back and forth on who has the right to go down and to actually claim these items. And it turns out that the international lawsuits were flying around. Colombia has come out on top with the ruling among the judges, to where Colombia is now saying, okay, we're going to be the ones that control this. We're going to go down. This is the most valuable shipwreck in the history of mankind at $17 billion. And I guess the thing to unwind for me is, what do you do with this stuff? Like, what is it going into museums? Like, if you have, like you're not going to go to a museum in Colombia and see 11 tons of silver. So like, Or whatever, millions of gold coins. You can look at a couple of gold coins, or you can look at, so the cultural heritage of this is very interesting. I was in Stockholm one time, and they were able to bring up an entire shipwreck. So the museum that you go to is not looking at a piece of gold or looking at an emerald. The entire ship was preserved. And so they were able to impregnate the wood down there with something that stabilized it. And they brought the whole thing up. So when you go into the museum, you're seeing the whole ship. And so that had, regardless of where the ship came from, the fact that it was there by that coast made it an incredible artifact. With this, the condition of the ship is probably going to deteriorate. They're not going to be able to bring up the actual ship. But you're going to have these artifacts. I can see a case where England is like, that was our riches. Probably even go back further. There's probably countries in Africa who are like, hold on, you came to our country and you pilfered this gold and these rubies. And when England was a monarchy, it gets very complicated very fast. Where would you land on after you read this whole thing? The people that spend money from America to actually find the ship and to go down and to do that, I think they deserve something because no one else knew where it was until it was discovered. And so it's super complicated to me. I don't think that the people that found, just because you found it, you shouldn't get 100%. I don't think that England should get 100% because I doubt that any of those gemstones came from England itself. That was part of when they were conquering the world. And Colombia, you know, it is in their waters. So I think that they have a valid claim, but I don't think it should be 100% in any of the directions.
Yeah, I think you have to ask yourself, though, when is something, I think it comes down to this, Ron, when is something no longer a graveyard? Like the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, they were carrying ore, and no one's like, man, I got to get down there and get me that ore, and we're going to bring that ore back up. They did go down and get the bell, and in getting the bell, they asked that no one else go down there. The families asked that no one else go down there and salvage a ship or pull anything off the ship except for the bell, because they feel like it's a graveyard. That's the excuse that has been used with the Titanic. We don't want salvage companies going down and salvaging the Titanic because it's a graveyard. And then they'll say the items that we have brought up, we put on display, because the ship is diminished. And they think at some point, it really depends upon, like the Edmund Fitzgerald, where it's at and how cold the water is, I think the Edmund Fitzgerald will always be around. The Titanic, though, is being eaten away at by little microbes. And at some point, they feel like the ship itself will just disappear. And then if you look at a wreck like this, isn't this wreck still a graveyard, even though that this happened at a different point in time? It seems like we're not treating it as a graveyard, and we're treating it as a wreck that has $17 billion up in the air.
So there were 600 men on the crew. 11 people survived.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
But it was over 300 years ago.
That's my point. Are you allowed to go into a graveyard that's 300 years old here in America and pilfer that graveyard? Or say, you know what we're going to do? And believe me, a lot of developers on Queen Anne would like to do it. We have probably the best real estate on Queen Anne Mountain, I call it, is a graveyard. And they'd love to go in and bulldoze that thing and start building homes, right? So at what, like 500 years from now, can you do it? 1,000 years from now, can you do it?
Well, what do you think about like Egypt? Like explorers went into graveyards in Egypt and took everything that was made of precious metals.
Yeah, well, we're not talking about Egypt. We were talking about this. So I just think we have to think about, if something's a graveyard, then it's a graveyard. And I don't know, for me, that there's a point in time in history where you know, you bring up this point, Ron, a great point of 600 men. It's like, hey, 600 people perished, and whether they perished 3 years ago or 300 years ago or 3,000 years ago, I think we have to remember that. I think that's important. At the same time, now that it's been located, if somebody doesn't go down there and get that $17 billion, someone's going to go down there and get that $17 billion.
I think to me, it's what you just described, and is something a historical artifact, and what's going to be done with it? And I think Egypt does apply, because like it was literally a tomb. And so when it was discovered, though, because it was so old, it's like, oh, we're just going to take these things and put them in a museum. Where to your argument, if you're Egyptian, you could say, time out. Like, that's a pharaoh. That's his graveyard. We want to leave it there. It belongs in the tomb where they put it in the tomb. It doesn't belong in the Louvre in Paris. It doesn't belong in the Natural History Museum in New York City. It belongs where they were honoring the dead when it happened. And the historians go, no, this is cultural now. This is an artifact. And so is there artifact and historical significance to these items 300 years later? Yeah. Do you just step over the bodies of 589 people? I guess.
Yeah.
Like, I guess you do.
I hope I'm not on display someday, like 1,000 years from now. So that's why you put me in an oven, you cook it, and you just splash it around Discovery Park. We'll see you on the other side of this.
Hey, it's Ron and Don here with Mitch Weeks. You know him as Mitch.Loans. And Mitch, a lot of people find themselves in this scenario. Maybe they're downsizing and they're like, where am I going to live when I sell this house? Because I don't have my other house yet. And it freaks them out, and sometimes they tap the brakes. Is there anything we can do in a loan way to help someone in that scenario?
Absolutely. We have a great new program. It's called Buy Before You Sell, and it's structured to help exactly those type of people. What you can do is you tap into the equity in your home in advance. So let's say you've been living in a house for a while, you've already paid it down, and about half of it's equity. You can get up to 80% of the value of your house in that equity. You get that in, and that's the down payment on your next home. Hmm. Not only that, but in this program, you're not hit for your debt on your old house or that loan because it's a 0% interest loan. And because of that, you can buy your next house before you have to sell your current house. It means you don't have to move twice, and it just adds a lot less stress.
Yeah, absolutely adds a lot less stress. So if that's a scenario for you, or you've been having a stumbling block, if I don't know where I'm going to live first before I sell this house, give Mitch a call, or you can contact us. It's mitch.loans or ronandonsitdown.com. Again, mitch.loans.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the Ron and Don Show. And this is kind of interesting. I started trail racing a number of years ago. And I had my own reasons for doing that, and I've shared that before. About a year ago, my son started working out, and we did his first trail race called the Reindeer Run with Northwest Trail Races. In fact, I met some of my best friends out with Northwest Trail Races. In fact, my friend Gretchen runs the Cougar Mountain Series. In fact, I was talking to her this morning. She's like, hey, are you and Joe going to come out and run the Cougar Mountain Series? And I said, I don't know if Joe and I are going to be out there, but maybe Ron's going to be out there because he's the newest trail runner. In fact, Ron, you had your first trail race over the weekend. And how was it?
It was not like running on a treadmill. I'll tell you that. It was, I'm glad I did it. Like I have been, you know, trying to put myself in situations where, you know, I'm guaranteed to not get more fit if I don't put myself in situations where I'm doing things that are around fitness. So I was looking around. I'd saw a scene that you've done that, the trail races. I had just sort of Googled like 5Ks. I was like, you know what? If I put a 5K on my calendar, that will motivate me, or hopefully motivate me, to know that that's coming, and it'll help me to, you know, train for it and just have a goal out there. And so this one came up. It was in the, what was that? Bridal Trails Park over on the east side. And it did do that. Like you go, oh my God, I got 2 weeks before this race. And so you go to the gym and you're, you know, I would be running on the treadmill and doing intervals and et cetera, ran around Lake Union to just get some time in. And so the thing that was different on this trail ride was, you know, you come right out of the gate and it goes up like immediately. And so I wasn't expecting that on the course. And that was very challenging for me to like immediately do, I think it was about a mile of rise, like straight out of the gate. Like you maybe went 20, 30 yards and then it was boom up. And so that was a definite challenge for me. I had been watching, I watched the Jason Kelce and Travis Kelce's podcast, and Jason just retired, and he talked about he was in, they were doing a thing. He does a thing for autism in the Philadelphia area. They were having a 5K, and so they sort of goaded him into running kind of at the last minute, but he's a professional athlete. And so he talked about this in their podcast, and he said that he finished in 47 minutes. And hit this similar type of thing where he hit a hill and then some stuff happened and he signed a couple autographs and I think he was drinking a couple beers along the way, whatever yeah. He was doing in a Jason Kelce way. And so that was kind of my goal. I was like, if I can get 45 minutes, which is not a good time. Like, I know that's not a good time. A 15-minute mile is not great, and 5K is just over 3 miles. And so the thing that I did that I'd never really done in the past is I reached out to some friends and invited other people to do it. I thought that that would also help me to stay accountable and to get the momentum going. So we ended up, I think you invited a couple other people as well, ended up with about like 8 or 9 people out there running. And so that was a big help. And I got to admit, I struggled. The hill was hard. Old man stuff, like an old knee injury popped up from 8 or 9 years ago that like felt like someone rammed an ice pick in my knee. So like stuff like that you just don't know until you do it. But I finished and I came in right at like 46 minutes. So a little over 46 minutes. So I was actually pretty pleased with that.
Yeah. Well, I'll say a couple things about that. Number one, that's the thing about warming up on a treadmill. You kind of, a lot of times people walk and then they jog and then they run. And you don't prepare to start running right up a hill. I remember when I was training for Rainier, when you come out of Paradise, if there's snow on the ground. A lot of people train for Rainier when there's no snow between Paradise and going up to Camp Muir. It's really different when you go up there and you train and you come out of Paradise, because you face these two ginormous hills right out of Paradise. And in snowy conditions, it can take you forever. And they're pretty daunting if you haven't done that before. And then you get on the other side of those two and you're like, now I'm supposed to go up to Camp Muir. So yeah, sometimes you just have to, if you're training on a treadmill, you got to jump on the treadmill and just start running, because it's, and put it 6, 7, 8, 9, 12 degrees, because that's the only way you can prepare for something like that. And then the other thing where you should give yourself a break, like Jason Kelce, I saw him running that 5K. He was doing that on pavement. Running a 5K on pavement is nothing like running a 5K in the woods. So if I run, and I think I ran this 5K in 31 minutes. I think my son ran it in 30. He beat me by 90 seconds. He's flying, man. He's great. So proud of him. Running in the woods, you just run a lot slower than if you're running on pavement. If I were to run, like when I run the St. Patrick's Day 5K, I can do that. I've done that in 21 minutes before. Another time I did it in 22, almost 23. So 21 to 23 minutes. And I would say I'm probably in similar shape. This taking an extra 10 minutes, it just does when you're outside and you're in the woods. It's a lot harder, especially some of the inclines. And at the same time, I find it more fulfilling, because when you run on pavement, sometimes you can just kind of check out, and that's one of the reasons people do it. When you trail run, you have to actively, you're actively running and feeling every step. And what was different about this, and where you have to give yourself lots of credit, is I talked to Gretchen about it. There are a lot of people signed up for the race. Usually the trail is packed, and even when you start, they usually send you out in waves. There are probably 70% of the participants that woke up and they saw all that rain on Saturday, and they're like, you know what? They can keep the money, because $15 that you paid helps to maintain all those trails. So they're like, yeah, you can keep the money, but I'm not showing up to run today.
Yeah, it was pouring.
Yeah. So the fact that you showed up, the fact that you finished, and the fact that you made sure that you had friends that were going to go out there to hold you accountable, because that's the thing. You can't look out the window and go, I'm not going, because you knew that, for instance, that Juan Carlos is going to be out there, and you knew that Charles is going to be out there. You knew that Gunnar O'Neill was going to be out there. I was going to be out there. So it holds you accountable and makes sure. So what did you learn from it, and do you think will you put another Northwest Trail race on your calendar, or are you done with trail racing?
No, I would. I'd be curious if there's someone listening that's like a doctor of the knee. I don't know what that is. I had this old knee injury, and it is the weirdest thing, because it's not a ligament. It's not like a sprain. It's just this very unusual thing. And like, I would love to like email me or hit me on my socials. I'd love to talk to someone that knows something about kneecaps, because I had injured my kneecap.
Is it pop or just sore?
It doesn't pop. It's just, it's a very strange soreness. And like, I can work through the muscle soreness and like my Achilles and calves and all that stuff, where you're just like, well, I'm just sore because of that. This is just a different deal. So if I can kind of solve this, I would like to do a lot more of it. But like, I ran on the treadmill this morning, and the treadmill, I'm if I just put a knee brace on, I'm fine. But coming up and down those hills and the uneven terrain on a trail, I enjoyed it. I like being out in the woods, but I need, I think, some expert advice on what you do about that type of knee pain. It's only one knee, and it's because of a specific injury I had years ago.
Cool thing about the Northwest Trail Race, if you haven't done it before, you can do a 5K, 10K. I've run a half a marathon, a full marathon with them. They'll take you to places that you haven't been before. So you'll be on the Redmond Watershed, and you'll see some bears out there. You'll be on Cougar Mountain. Hopefully you don't see any cougars. The Cougar Mountain Trail Race is really cool. The Bridal Trail Race, they have a winter season where you can run all season. They run out of Seward Park. They have the Reindeer Run. And the really cool run that I'm going to do next week is up on Woodby Island. So it gives you a chance to get up early, grab a coffee, you jump on the ferry, you head on over. And the cool thing is that that I love and my son loves. If you're running a longer race when you're out in the middle of the woods, all of a sudden you'll stop at a station. It's a water station, and they got candy and chips and all kinds of stuff to help you refill your sodium and your potassium, because you need that, your electrolytes when you're running. And then at the end of this race, you could tell all the people that were supposed to be there by all the snacks that were there, that nobody was there to eat, right? And they had soup for you and hot cider and all kinds of hummus and candy and potato chips. And it's one of the only times I get to eat potato chips, and I eat a bunch of them. So anyway, Northwest Trail Runs, you can walk those, you can run those, you can skip, whatever you want to do, is a great way for you to get out and see the Pacific Northwest. And I have to say, I had an 8-year-old girl pass me and beat me, and I had a woman, she must have been in her 70s, and she was an effing hammer. She went by me, I could not catch her. Hey, you guys, thanks for listening to this episode of the Ron and Don Show. We really appreciate it. If you need to get in touch with us, just reach out. You go to ronanddon.com. Everything is there for you. Want to thank our good friends at Les Schwab for sponsoring today's show. And also want to thank Mitch at Mitch.Loans. In fact, he's working on a loan for one of our buyers right now, and he can work on a loan for you. Don't forget, Wells Fargo, all the big banks, they're great. The problem is they don't answer the phone on the weekend. Real estate happens on the weekend, right? And so a lot of times, in fact, tomorrow we're going to send in an offer after 5 o'clock, and banks don't typically pick up the phone and answer the phone after 5 o'clock. But you know what? Mortgage brokers do. And so that's what Mitch is. He's a mortgage broker, and he'll go out and find a product that works for you. And he doesn't get paid by underwriting you unless you do a deal. A lot of big banks won't underwrite you because it's too expensive. And if you're not underwritten in a competitive environment, then a lot of times the realtor on the other end, yeah, they'll take up your offer and they just throw in the waste paper basket if there's other offers there, even if they're for less that have been underwritten. So you want to make sure you get underwritten. Ask Mitch about that, Mitch.Loans. All right. And thanks to Ron and Don Real Estate as well. Thanks for allowing us to be friends, your broadcasters, your real estate agents. If you need help with buying, selling, or investing, we are here for you. Again, everything is at ronanddon.com. You keep your head up and shoulders back. We'll see you next time. You've been listening to the Ron and Don Show, episode 706, only on the Ron and Don Radio Network.
Now keep your head up and your shoulders back and keep blowing that trumpet, and we'll see you next time.
Only
on the Ron and Don Radio Network.